Okay, the case of Armstrong versus Robitaille. Ms. James.
May it please the court, I'm Shelley James and I'm here on behalf of Adam Armstrong in this appeal of a family protective order. This case is a little different than cases that normally appear before this court. Protective orders are highly unusual in the circuit courts and therefore exceptionally unusual in being appealed to this court. There really is not any binding case law on protective orders, anything relating to the code sections that are relevant here. In this case, there was a full hearing in circuit court, as your honors, I'm sure, have reviewed it, and a protective order was granted to my client. However, he was not granted the full relief that he requested from the very beginning, which was that the protective order include both himself and his daughter.
Don't we have a waiver problem in this case, the 5A18?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe we do, and I believe that for several reasons. First of all, I will point out counsel for Ms. Roadcap and I have discussed this matter and discovered there was an attorney who was hired for my client just before I was hired to represent him on appeal. That attorney filed a document on January 18th of 2018. It is titled A Written Notice of Objection that states the objections after the order was entered. Neither Mr. Wetzel nor I were aware that this document was in the record, and that is why it does not appear in the appendix, and neither of us reference it. I will say Mr. Wetzel actually was the one who brought it to my attention that it was there. I do not believe he in any way tried to conceal this document or take advantage of my oversight. He has been very forthcoming, and at this point he believes that the 5A18 argument is not appropriate in this case, is what he has informed me. I will say that even if this document were not in the record, I still don't believe that there is a waiver, a 5A18 argument. In closing argument, the attorney argued the evidence here and was mainly successful in that the court in its findings basically found that Ms. Roadcap was not credible. I will admit the court also found that my client was not the best person in the world either, but
It was a close case.
The judge specifically said that. But he did make some very specific findings. And in the petition, my client asked for this relief, so the judge was well aware that this relief was requested. In closing argument...
Can I ask one question here? Because this was appealed to the circuit court, correct?
Yes.
Because there was a protective order given below.
Yes.
And there, the protective order included the daughter.
Yes.
Right? So here, given that the circuit court is, of course, what we review, and the circuit court, as fact finder, said, I think both sides have credibility issues. I do think that Mr. Armstrong has proven by preponderance of the evidence, I think he said something like, you don't need but 50.1%, and he's proved that, but not by a lot more. Why then the fact that he didn't include the daughter, and it was brought to his attention that the daughter was not included, and he just kept going, circuit court judge kept going. Why don't we have to accept the credibility findings and decision, therefore, the fact finding?
This is a highly unusual case as far as sufficiency and the standard of review is concerned. We actually want you to accept the judge's credibility determinations because he found my client, the appellant in this case, was more credible than Ms. Roadcap. But then he proceeded to exclude the child from the protective order. And the evidence in this case, in some cases, the uncontroverted evidence in this case, is that there was a danger to the child. There are three instances in particular that I think go to that point. The first would be the video of Ms. Roadcap getting out of a car that is running, that is not put into park, that is not turned off, letting this car, she gets out of the car, lets the car keep going. And this is at a point where this child is, I believe, 14 months old. This is not at a point where she's not used to being around the child, where she, you know, heaven forbid she actually forgot the child earlier in the child's life, too. The complete lack of recognition of what is going on in her surroundings. This child was exceptionally lucky that her mother didn't park this car on a downward slope, didn't park it closer to Route 33, which is a very heavily traveled not interstate road in the Harrisonburg area. This could have been a tragedy in this child's life.
But based on the record, with the judge saying that the appellant had failed to produce, quote, any evidence to demonstrate that the child should be included, why would this not, the car rolling, why would that not have been just deemed by the judge as the trier of fact to have been just simply negligent? She was engaged in a fight, essentially, or an argument, and she got out of the car and the car rolled.
That's the kind of negligence, Your Honor, that leads to felony convictions. In cases that involve proof beyond a reasonable doubt. When the judge said he didn't see any evidence, this was uncontroverted evidence. So this is a case that didn't involve beyond a reasonable doubt. It didn't involve clear and convincing. It involved a preponderance of the evidence. And clearly, that was a situation that greatly endangered this child. Even if
the
you take it...
children get endangered when parents do stupid but not badly intended things, or just have accidents. It seems the trial judge here, to follow up on Judge Decker's question, decided that this was a heated moment, but not an intentional moment to harm the child in any way.
Unfortunately, Your Honor, those tend to be the circumstances that lead to the worst consequences.
Well, can I ask you, though, about the... When Ms. Roadcap arrived at Mr. Armstrong's house, the time where she knocked on the door, he went to the door, wasn't sure he was going to let her in. He testified, but he did. She said she wanted to talk to him. They went and sat in the living room. Mm-hmm. And then she said, "I hate this house." And he said, "Why? He's never done anything to you." I'm paraphrasing. But she said, "Well, I'd like to burn it down with you and Livia in it." Can you talk to us about that one?
Yes, Your Honor. That is another example. The second example I was going to get to was the times that she actually came to his home while he had the daughter, Olivia, in his care. This is a very good example of where she comes into his home and makes threats. I believe she came another time. She's drunk. She's throwing up. Creating a disturbance for this child in the middle of the night. And then there's a third incident where she actually brings the police to the house and has the police enter my client's house without knocking. The only notice that he has is that he hears somebody coming up the stairs. It is, thank the Lord, that the police didn't have their guns drawn, that my client didn't have a gun or something in his hands, thinking that there was a prowler that had gotten into his house. And this is while she knows the child is in the house and in his care. These were purposeful actions on her part. These were purposeful statements that she made. And these are incidents that she basically either agreed happen or didn't controvert at all. And we all know the court can't ignore uncontroverted evidence.
But So wouldn't we, though, still have to find, as, given that we're an appellate court and not a fact-finding court, wouldn't we have to find that the trial court was just plainly wrong in saying that that he didn't think that the level of danger was enough to add the daughter to the protective order, given, I assume, that would decide custody right there, too, because if the mother can't have any sort of contact with the child, then she can't take the child for half the time, which seemed to be their arrangement.
It would certainly affect custody, Your Honor, but in any protective order, if there is a subsequent order, that can change the custody issues. And if a court after this order made some different determination about custody, that would be up to that court subsequent to this.
That sort of leads to my next question. And I don't know, I mean, obviously, I can only ask what's within the record, but is this in any way been overturned by subsequent orders that are in the record that would render any of this moot? Or, I mean, don't go based just on the moot question, because you can get into a discussion of what's moot or not, but I think you understand what I'm asking, and I'm only asking within the record, because that's all, as you know, we can consider on appeal.
Within the record, there is nothing that would suggest that. I can tell Your Honors that there has been a continuing custody and divorce case. It is my understanding that this judge issued an opinion on custody and visitation just yesterday or the day before. I have not seen that order. I'm not trial counsel in that case. I believe Mr. Wetzel is trial counsel. I don't know if he's seen that order yet or not. I will say it's my understanding that it does not have a 50-50 custody arrangement. And it's my understanding that my client does have primary physical custody of this child. And I will say, Your Honor, the additional advantage of including the child in the protective order, even if it's just that the mother will commit no acts of domestic violence in front of this child, would be helpful to this child. It would be a reminder to this adult that she needs to be aware when she has her child around, and she needs to keep her actions and her behavior and her mind under control, which she clearly does not, and which the judge clearly found in this case.
I guess it's my concern here is at this juncture we're looking at a cold, hard record, and we haven't had the opportunity that the trial judge had to make some of these assessments. It puts us in a very difficult situation.
It does, Your Honor, and it's doubly difficult because the judge, who did see everybody, found that my client was the one who was more credible.
A little bit.
By a little bit, but still, that's the standard here. And that kind of turns the standard of review on appeal on its head, because do you, as the traditional standard says, review the evidence in the light most favorable to the appellee, which is usually because that's the way the judge ruled. But here, the judge explicitly ruled that the evidence favored my client, even by just a little bit. So
with
on appeal,
regard to the protective order against him, but not necessarily with regard to the protective order against the child, right?
Which is another issue also, Your Honor. Once the protective order is granted as to him, the case law, there is no case law, and the statute is completely unclear as to what the standard becomes for adding other people into the protective order.
Well, it makes it awfully difficult to share custody when one party can't, has a protective order against the other party, and there's a infant child or a toddler involved.
And this is something that domestic attorneys have to deal with every day, and that circuit court judges have to deal with every day. And eventually something gets figured out in the manner there. In this case, all Your Honors have is this protective order. We believe that this is actually an important case. There are not many protective order cases. There certainly, I don't believe, are any published protective order cases. It has a very unusual standard of review to examine, and I'm going to reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you. Mr. Wetzel?
Thank you, Thank you. May it please the court. I'm Derek Wetzel here for Christie Road Cap. I think, first of all, Your Honor's questions have been insightful and to the points that I think I was intending to make a great deal of them. I think this case turned on one corroborating witness. There's Mr. Giddens that testified that he saw Ms. Roadcap arguing with Mr. Armstrong in the yard while he was mowing the grass and hitting him on the chest, kind of, you know, like this on the chest a little bit. And I think the court has viewed that as the thing that pushes them across the top. In my view, I don't think that there was any decision made here that indicated that one was less bad than the other when it comes to credibility. I think that the court's determination was pretty clear that he found both of them to have significant credibility issues. The next point I would make is that it's clear to me that because we are talking so much about the facts of this case, this is exactly why we give so much authority and credence to the trial court's capacity for making these decisions. As you've indicated, this is a cold, hard record. You haven't been able to see the witnesses. You haven't been able to view them and see how they behave on the stand, which is such a big factor in making the determinations of credibility.
Well, the trial judge made some factual findings in addition to making his statement, and he did talk about the fact that he observed Ms. Roadcap at court, and he observed tremendous, I can't remember the exact word, but animosity toward her husband, and an enmity.
Very erratic is the word that he used.
Very erratic.
Yes.
And so, if that's a factual finding, and he said erratic, I believe, several times, and there's uncontradicted testimony, I believe, and correct me if it's not uncontradicted, that she, on one occasion, as I questioned Ms. James, appeared at his house, said she just wanted to talk. They went in the living room, and she talked about how much she hated the house. He asked why, and she said, "I just would love to burn it down with you and Livia in here." Given, if that's uncontradicted testimony, why isn't the trial court just plainly wrong, if he finds her erratic, he's made that finding, to not include the child in the protective order?
Well, I think a couple of things, Your Honor. I think that because even though he found all of those negative things about her, he still drew the conclusion that there wasn't enough evidence to include the child in this protective order and still called it a very close call. I think that
a very close call just as to whether to issue the protective order as to Mr. Armstrong.
Whether to issue it at all. And I don't think that the statute then just requires by automation that family members then become included on protective orders. That I think would really steal a lot of the authority of a judge to decide just who ought to be included. There's lots and lots of circumstances where you would never include family members, older children, that have never been around or witnessed, for instance. I mean, there's lots of examples of that. My understanding of his ruling is that I don't think that he believed that was a real intentioned thing on her behalf. She made quite a few statements that led him to the conclusion that she had behaved erratically, those things I think were viewed as mere arguments, in the heat of the battle kind of thing. Next, I would say that I think judge understood.
A lot of heat of the battle arguments, though, from what the trial judge and the record seems to indicate, pretty extreme statements stated about what she would like to have happen to him, and some strong ones he made toward her, too. But
yes, sir, and as you all have inquired a little bit, there's even more discussion about that in the opinion that we've very recently received yesterday, that obviously you all don't have the opportunity to see or view. And
now that opinion has nothing to do with the protective order, right?
Well, he talks about it, but it doesn't have any. Right. I think the stipulation that we all reached at trial on the custody investigation case was that while this is on appeal, that he doesn't have any authority to take action to amend the protective order until we know what's going to happen with it here. That discussion is in there, but at any rate, it's not.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there is always the opportunity to get a second protective order. At any given time, the parties can get.
If there's justification for it, sure, yes.
Additional evidence.
Right, when something else may or may not occur, then you can try again, so to speak. And to finish up in response to your inquiry, I think the trial court recognized that some of that behavior from her stemmed from the fact that because the juvenile court judge had included the child, she had not seen her child for the better part of 2 months at that time. She was quite emotional about that and upset about that. It was over the holidays, and I think that was part of what impacted her behavior on the stand. I think that I would I guess maybe lastly draw the court's attention to just the definitions and the statements that are in the statute themselves. This talks about commission of family abuse. And family abuse is well defined in the statute. And I'm paraphrasing a little bit myself here, but it's bodily injury or threat of bodily injury, putting one in reasonable apprehension of death or bodily harm. In this situation, unless we are going to decide that that there is sort of some kind of automatic extension to family members, there has to be some test to whether or not those family members were also subjected to family abuse. Do they need a protective order against the family members in addition to whoever the primary petitioner might be?
And the black eye, you would argue, was explained as an accident.
Well, even the petitioner indicated he thought it could have been an accident. In his speculation about what may or may not have happened, there's a whole sort of plethora of list of things in the brief that are purported to be indicators of family abuse as regards to Olivia, but I think that most of them don't fall short of the definition of what family abuse is. And to the extent that they don't, many of those allegations, statements that Mr. Armstrong made towards Ms. Roadcap, attributed to Ms. Roadcap, were things that were in dispute, that she denied making and so forth. With regards to when the police were brought into the home, there was a dispute about whether or not it was still the marital residence at that time. I don't think there's any dispute that her name was not on the deed. She didn't have title to it, but there was dispute about when exactly they had their final separation. Evidence all the way from January of that year into, I think, June, perhaps, of that year, about reconciling, getting back together, breaking up again multiple different times. And so they disagreed. The two of the primary parties here had stark disagreement about whether or not that home was still the marital home at that time.
That incident occurred in June, did you say?
I believe
January 20th supposed final separation.
That was Mr. Armstrong's assertion that January 20th was the last time that they had reconciled. Ms. Roadcap testified that it was much later than that. I believe that she said it was June. Please don't hold me specifically to that date because I don't remember it exactly in my mind at the moment. But it was at or about the time that this incident happened with the police going in with her to get her personal belongings out of the home.
Mr. Wetzel, while you're at a breather, taking a breather, I just want to go back to the 5A18. You're essentially withdrawing that.
Yes, in going through the file in preparation, I located that document.
I don't want to use your time. I just
it's okay.
I just wanted to make sure we get that on the record.
I was about done anyway, and I don't want to. I wanted to make sure. I think Ms. James accurately.
You said that is in the record, though. Or
I don't. I don't know that it is actually in the record. It was in my file.
Well, thank you for your candor.
He's just being in good faith. Yep. You're just withdrawing the 518.
Yes, I am, okay. Because I found it. I brought
we
it to Ms. James' attention.
Yep.
So, and I think that effectively preserves the issues. Thank you. If there's some more questions?
Hearing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. James, your remaining minute or whatever it is.
Your Honors, I will point out that on page 247 of the appendix, the judge did find explicitly that there was family abuse in this case. Under the statute, once there is family abuse, under 16.1-279.1, one of the things that a judge can then put in a protective order is that there'll be no contact with other family members. You don't have to have a separate protective order for every family member and prove family abuse in relation to every family member. That's not the way this statute is written. Otherwise, you'd have to file a protective order and make each person in the family that you wanted covered a different petition. There'd be, if it's a family of 10, you'd have to have protective orders for each one of them. That's not the way this is worded. I must say, I do agree with Mr. Wetzel that even though the statute doesn't specifically say there has to be some reason to include a person in there, I think in this case there is. As I mentioned, there were three things that I thought led to this. We talked about the video, which was in November of 2017. We talked about bringing the police and her coming to the house a number of times, and that was in June of 2017. I will say, I don't think it matters if this was a marital home or not. This is a mother who did not have a way into the house. She called the police. She broke in with the police. She didn't yell, "We're coming up, it's just me and the police." She did nothing. What notified my client that they were there was he heard footsteps coming up the steps to where he and his daughter were. I can't really imagine anything being more terrifying. The third thing that I will mention, and Judge Beals brought up something related to this, is the numerous car accidents that this woman was in. Apparently, one of them being where the child got a black eye while mother was on vacation. And the last of those car accidents, I believe the testimony was there had been five or six during the time that my client had known his wife. The last one was sometime in September or October of 2017. This is not just a case of one incident. It's not just a case of one bad month. It's a case of constant erratic behavior, of vitriol towards her husband, where there is uncontroverted evidence, and the court found that she was the less credible person here for some very good reasons, both her behavior, her, quite honestly, perjury in the affidavits, which we haven't really discussed, and the video and texting that corroborated what my client had to say, in addition to Mr. Gibson. I would say also I appreciate Mr. Wetzel saying that the argument is preserved. I believe that even if we didn't find that document, that it would be preserved because my client's attorney at trial did mention some of these facts related specifically to the child in his closing argument and did specifically ask for the protective order in relation to the child in that argument.
Can I ask you real quick, you said the finding of family of family violence was on Joint Appendix 247?
Family abuse. It's at lines 6 and 7 on page 247.
Okay, I see.
I find that family abuse has occurred.
All right, we'll step down and greet counsel. Thank you very much. And then